you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour, and thank you for tuning into the Twilight Histories. This is a show inspired by role-playing games, in which you are the hero. You will travel to different worlds in the multiverse. Some are familiar, others are totally exotic. Today, you will hear part two of Rings in the Mist by Kevin Valbenesi. A quick shout-out to all our patrons. Thank you so much for your support. This show was 100% funded by you through Patreon, and it would not have happened without you. If you're a listener who hasn't joined us on Patreon yet, there are so many reasons to do so. You get early access to shows, tons of shows only available to patrons, Twilight Histories merch as rewards, and even opportunities to contribute your ideas for shows. But the most important reason why you're joining us on Patreon is that you are investing in the future of this show. Join us on Patreon by going to twilighthistories.com and follow the link. And now, on to today's show, Rings in the Mist, Part 2, by Kevin Valbenesi.
You press yourself against the ramparts of ancient Athlone's walls and pop a fresh magazine into your Radeon pulse rifle. It's your last magazine, and with just 30 rounds to work with, you can't get your hopes high. Taking up your position, you peer up and over the ramparts, gazing through your scope at the throngs of the hooded menaces who slowly march on the city, firing blinding bolts of energy from their crossbows. You take aim and squeeze off a few rounds, knocking down two of the attackers, but shedding not a single drop of blood. More hooded figures emerge from the mist and drag their fallen out of sight, only for more to appear, ready and willing to fight. You can hear Seamus' frustration as he launches a plasma grenade, sending a group of the hooded figures flying like bowling pins. But again, their forms remain intact, and they are simply dragged away by those still standing. Even as Seamus fires and knocks down those sent to recover the fallen, yet more arrive to pull them away. It's like fighting a Hydra, and you have no means to stunt the regeneration of its many heads. Instead, the shadowy menace keeps up the pressure, producing more and more fighters as you all struggle to conserve what few rounds you still have. Your only respite is that the enemy appear to be concentrating their assault on one section of the wall. And although every time Seamus' crew come to report inactivity on the other side, he steadfastly refuses to pull support away, fearing envelopment and the total destruction of his forces. A stray shot slams into one of Seamus' soldiers, evaporating them where they stand. Seamus flies into a rage and blasts the enemy with another plasma grenade, but his wrath is ultimately impotent as yet more of the enemy appear to dispassionately carry off their fallen comrades. Seamus ducks down, avoiding a fatal blast himself. You see the hope vanish from his eyes as he searches his person for a magazine, only to come up empty time and again. He tosses his rifle and pulls his Radeon pistol from his hip holster, and pops up to squeeze off a few rounds before being forced back down by concentrated enemy fire. You hear Abu Bakr curse as he throws down his own rifle and draws his pistol. Before he can even peer over the ledge, a blast surges overhead, just missing him. He hurls himself back down, slamming his fist against the stone. He tries again, but once more, the enemy keeps him pinned down. Others are not so lucky, with another soldier next to Seamus vanishing before your eyes as they leap up to fire off a plasma grenade. Whoever they are, your enemies are determined to wipe you from the face of the earth. And in your moment of desperation, you begin to understand why this world is so empty. Whether the mighty builders of this place fled to another realm or were themselves overcome is beyond you. But the conclusion is the same. This was a foe who could not be removed. It's only a matter of time now before they mount the walls and turn you into little more than the mist which conceals the true size of the Horde. Seamus slams his fist against one of the ancient cannons, hammering against it, alternating between profanities and prayers as he tries to order the thing into action, but to no avail. Perhaps it once protected these walls, but now it stands by as a silent witness to the shadowy multitudes who advance without pause. Seamus brings his fist down on it again, glancing against the sphere set into the side of the cannon. As you look over at your hopeless commander, you notice that the sphere he struck is not unlike the one set into the podium in the observatory. Your mind races, and before you know it, you're skirting over to Seamus' position, shoving him aside as you reach for the sphere. You see that the orb is covered in fanciful, spiraling designs, as the ring it's set into. But the designs don't match. They don't quite flow together. You spin the sphere in place, turning it over and over, trying to match the flourishes of the ring surrounding it. And finally, you do. You hear a distinct click, and then the sphere becomes iridescent, lighting up itself along the lines of its design, then spreading the light throughout the length of the cannon until you can hear it rumble to life. Not soon after, iridescent lines shoot out from the base of the cannon and race along the walls of the city until it reaches another cannon, stirring it as well. Soon, you can hear the machines coming to life all along the walls. And then you feel it. It's like static in the air, the charge building up, lifting the hairs on your skin. The sensation builds and builds until finally the cannon fires, unleashing a concentrated energetic beam. Peer over the walls and see the remains of cloaks blowing about, while the ground is seared in a long, thin stretch. You're jolted aside as the cannon swivels and fires again. You roll and get to a kneeling position, watching as the other cannons pivot on their bases and fire. You glance over the ramparts, watch as the hooded phantoms are torn asunder by every blast. The cannons do not let up, firing upon any of the enemy number foolish enough to step past the protective veil of the mist. Eventually, none remain in the open, leaving the battlefield covered with smoldering scars and craters. You wait a beat, expecting the next sortie to venture forth, but seconds turn to minutes. And soon enough, it's clear that the enemy is not returning. No shadow or wisp betrays any movement behind the curtain of fog, and as if to declare a job well done, the cannons turn erect, with a number of them letting off steam, and more than a few shedding parts as they jolt in place. Your desperate last defense did not come without cost, it would appear, and one can hardly expect more out of the gear that hasn't been fired in centuries, or perhaps millennia.
"I'll be damned," remarks Seamus. "I'm starting to see why they sent you down here."
Seamus surveys the battleground, picking up his rifle and using the scope to check for enemy movement. "Satisfied?" Seamus shoves the weapon into your arms,
his eyes steely and frigid. But maybe I should have done that before I lost all those good men and women.
That's not fair, you shout. If you didn't hit the right piece, I never would have known. And you told me you tried everything. Well, it's obvious you didn't.
Don't you dare step out of line. Seamus shoves you back and you almost fall over. But Abu Bakr grabs hold of you, steadying you. You have my gratitude for saving our skins this time. But don't think that buys you the right to lord over me or anyone else. You do your job, and you do it quickly before we lose another person. You understand?
Seamus signals to his remaining forces. One third of you stay here for now and man the walls.
Hopefully, these things will fire again. But just in case, you keep watch and let us know if the enemy comes back. If they're in number, you know what to do. The rest of you are with me. We'll escort the Egghead and Abu Bakr back to the observatory, and then we fortify the inner city just in case.
As a couple of soldiers approach, Seamus stops them.
You two, grab the emergency beacon and prime it. We're out of here at the next sign of trouble.
The soldiers acknowledge the order and hustle off. Seamus turns his gaze to you once more, if only for a moment, before he too marches off. A solid pat on the back from Abu Bakr lets you know it's time to go. You take a moment to look out over the battlefield, and then to the still, vibrant lines running on between the cannons. And you hope that whatever miracle you just performed won't be a one-off. Trusting in the ingenuity of the ancients, you strike out for the observatory, with Abu Bakr at your side.
You stand under the luminous dome, one hand resting on the golden sphere, and the other holding onto the podium. You turn the sphere slowly, setting the heavens in motion, casting the observatory's gaze across the galaxy. You crane your neck as you try and pick out anything significant within the sea of stars, but nothing leaps out at you, and no matter how you turn the sphere to align it with the podium, cannot seem to find the trick that will transform this room from a looking glass into a doorway. You step away from the podium to take a break, earning a chuckle from Abu Bakr. He minds the machinery, keeping an eye out for any strange signals, but none of the displays have changed at all. He takes your place at the podium and begins to turn the sphere, conducting his own search of the heavenly bodies.
I suppose the masters of this place were not so simple as to reduce their technology to one trick.
Abu Bakr steps away from the podium, folding his arms behind his back as he begins to take in the scenes in relief which decorate the walls and the corridors leading to this chamber. He runs his hands over them, as if to commune directly with the subjects in each scene.
Do you not find it curious that the ancients left no written record behind? I have not seen one line of script, hieroglyphics, or even runes throughout every city I visited here in this world. All they left us were these images, which still leave much to the imagination.
You pace about as well, searching for any detail you may have missed earlier on. You pass the reflecting pool and the statue of the three-faced god which rests in its center. The mechanism by which the cannons fired has you convinced that you've missed some decorative details which may actually be the master key to this supposed temporal engine. You have some hunches, I take it.
I do.
When we were here last, you mentioned a rather unpronounceable string of syllables. Were you talking about the people who built this place?
Perhaps. The Tuatha De Danann, one of the mythical peoples said to have inhabited Ireland back in the mists of time.
Abu Bakr gestures to the figures in flowing robes featured on the reliefs.
particularly in the scene where these figures disembark from their ships to greet the Neolithic peoples. Legends say that they arrived under the cover of a fierce storm, blackening the skies for 3 days as they made landfall. They were gods, or at least as close to gods as man might become. They conquered the island and made it their realm, wherein they set about conducting great feats and forming a kingdom. Abu Bakr moves to the next panel, where the scene depicts dark clouds and new ships arriving in the distance. But as so often happens, invaders came. The wrathful Formorians landed and fought great battles with the Duodedannon, devastating the land. And while the Duodedannon emerged victorious for a time, they could not withstand another wave of invaders who came in search of the riches and wonders of their kingdom. And so it was that eventually they withdrew through portals into the other world, where they could live in serenity forever.
Do you think there's a kernel of truth in that story? I mean, maybe the gods were the people who built this place, sure. And maybe the invaders are our shadowy friends out there.
All things are possible, given infinite time and space. But what I can't understand is why all of the cities were abandoned. If our enemy conquered the island, then why not take over the cities and use them for yourselves? They only attacked us when we entered the cities at first, but as far as I have seen, even to this day, they have never occupied a single one. Do you not find that strange?
Around the room again, still searching for any significant detail, while Abu Bakr keeps his attention on the reliefs. You turn your attention to the reflecting pool in the statue, finding little else to work with. The water is less than an inch deep, and the statue, realistic as it is, does not offer any intriguing detail, save for the 3 faces of the god it depicts. And who might this fellow be here?
That would be Lug, a champion of the Duodedannon. He laid low the Formorians, and for a time, reigned as king. He has often been associated with the Roman god Mercury, or Hermes, as he was known to the Greeks.
You look over the statue again, and find that the base is not one solid piece of masonry. Rather, it's composed of 3 discs, each ringed with intricate geometric designs. You touch the first base, and while you find it solid and heavy, you do notice that it has a bit of give to it. Now, Hermes, I know. He could conduct the souls of the dead to the afterlife, Hades or Elysium, depending on their merit. You push against the base and find that the statue turns, but only with great effort. Just to turn it a few degrees, you need to exert considerable force, leaving you exhausted almost immediately. You take a step back and shake your arms out, wondering if the statue is actually supposed to turn, or if you're just pushing a big rock around. Abu Bakr, how is it that the Duodedannon travel to their version of the afterlife?
The Duodedannon held the ring as sacred and powerful above all else. Rings could be used to conjure mystical creatures, or tap into the latent energies of the earth. Though they were immortal, the Duodedannon could be killed by violence, and when their kin buried them, they fashioned great burial mounds, interring the fallen every time within a ring. But the tombs were not sealed off. Rather, the builders created passageways into the resting place of their kin, and once a year, so the legends say, when the heavenly bodies aligned correctly, the passageways, the rings, became bridges to the afterlife.
So, the dead could return to the living through these rings.
No, not exactly. The dead remained confined to their tombs, but they could commune with anyone present, and if one so wished, they could gain access to the realms of the dead through the mounds.
Something clicks in the back of your mind. Disassociated thoughts race about, bridging the gaps between neurons, forming the inklings of greater understanding. You look to the dome-shaped ceiling of the observatory. Think on the ringed structure of the city and the complex here, and the passageways by which one gains access to the site. But something is still missing. You're sure of it. And so you turn to Abu Bakr with one more burning question on the tip of your tongue. Abu Bakr, which day did those passageways become accessible?
On the winter solstice.
That's all you needed to hear. You recall the strange angles at which the passageways to the observatory were set, and you come to the conclusion that the builders set them intentionally to align with that ominous day. But then, you've got a big problem if you have to wait until the solstice for any potential portal to open. You cast your eyes about the room and look for anything which might be turned to align with the solstice. But of everything which might be turned or tuned, you could only find the statue of the three-headed god, the Celtic Hermes with his triple aspects. Come and help me with this. You wave Abu Bakr over and motion for him to assist you with the statue's base. You both wrap your arms around it, and then, just as you're about to start pushing, another thought comes to mind. What are we lining up? Look at the statue and its base, finding nothing in particular which sticks out, except, of course, for the triple visage of the god, Lug. His three pairs of eyes are all wide, his faces all bearing an expression of awe or surprise, as if stunned by the first rays of the dawn. Okay. Let's try like this. You and Abu Bakr push the pedestal, turning it with considerable effort, turning it until two of the three faces are aligned with the corridors. You feel the stones lock in place, and then the other stones in the statue's base begin to spin on their own. Beneath your feet, you notice the reflecting pool is glowing now, and you can feel a powerful current running through it. You and Abu Bakr leap back, and just in time too, as the statue, in utter defiance of reality, begins to sink into the reflecting pool, vanishing into a maelstrom of radiance. The equipment scattered around the room goes off, registering the unique signature of a portal through time and space. The chamber shakes, and you cast your eyes to the ceiling, expecting the roof to come down on your heads. But instead, you see four amorphous shapes emerging out of the starscape before solidifying into rings of gold, each with four points directed inward, as if to mark a specific spot in the night sky. The reflecting pool's turbulence becomes more violent, causing it to expand and take up more of the floor. You and Abu Bakr scurry back, trying to avoid falling into the gaping mouth. Peering within it, you see the throat of the vortex, spiraling in a resplendent dance of color, shape, and texture, flowing downward and undulating with great violence. The commotion draws in Seamus and a few of his soldiers, all who join you in utter awe at the portal in the center of the room. The air is charged. The hair on your arms and the back of your neck stands erect, pinned straight. Even the pressure in the room has changed, and it seems to be urging you into the portal which rages where the reflecting pool once was. The equipment scattered around the room beeps and clicks in high-pitched monotony as every screen registers an incredibly powerful signal. Seamus walks right up to the edge of the portal. Planting his feet firmly on the ground, he peers down into its mouth, his face luminous. He stands there in utter silence, mouth agape, and eyes wide despite the near blinding light. Seamus looks so lost that eventually, two of his soldiers pull him back from the edge, which snaps him out of whatever enchantment he was laboring under.
Well, I'll be damned. They did it?
The bastards figured out how to make a bloody wormhole.
Seamus motions for his soldiers to spread out around the room, with each removing a small tablet from their pockets. They begin to take photos of everything in the room, meticulously documenting the portal from all angles, as well as the podium and the newly manifested locators on the ceiling.
I'll give you this one, Egghead. You did good. Now, do you care to explain how it all works?
I don't know how it works. I had a hunch, and now that's open in the middle of the room. Honestly, I couldn't tell you where or even when it goes.
Ah, wait to spoil the moment. I was genuinely impressed with you. I was.
Seamus approaches the podium and spins the orb around, sending the sky into a nauseating spiral. As he does so, the portal becomes agitated, growing and diminishing in the violence of its torrent, filling the air with an even more powerful electric current. You step over and seize the sphere, stopping the celestial display and returning the portal to a precarious equilibrium.
I'm going to give you one more chance to impress me. You figure out how this thing works and see if you can chart a course somewhere more hospitable than here, just to see how the land lays.
Seamus shoves past you, signaling for his soldiers to follow. I expect results by the time I come back. You clench your jaw and your fists, but a gentle hand on your shoulder soothes your indignance. Abu Bakr shakes his head as he watches Seamus departing.
Don't let old Seamus spoil the moment. As far as you and I are concerned, the real fun begins here, does it not?
Abu Bakr gestures to the locators on the ceiling.
I wonder if these contraptions here mark the destination of the wormhole.
You gaze intently at the obvious locators, surmising that while Abu Bakr is likely correct in some sense, the existence of several in comparison to the solitary wormhole means that there must be an additional mechanism for selecting a definite destination. To plunge in now might leave one floating aimlessly amongst the stars. Or worse. Returning to the podium, you place your hands on the sphere and slowly rotate it, moving the night sky to and fro, trying to ascertain if the locators take to any particular section of the night sky. If the solstice was the trick to opening the portal, then it should track that some heavenly alignment should betray the secret of these rings. You start with all the obvious constellations, and thankfully enough, the dome is an accurate enough representation of the earthly night sky to make locating them a trivial matter. Ursa Major, Minor, and Orion, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, all yield no apparent result. It's not until the night sky passes over the constellation of Sagittarius that the locators spring to life, rushing across the dome to lock on to the positions of the most radiant stars which make up the centaur's body. The very metal of the locators begins to glow as if fresh from the forge. The portal itself grows violent for a moment before assuming a rather calm state, more like water swirling down the drain than a vicious whirlpool. Everything seems to be in alignment, and you marvel at the poetry of it all. The ancients had no doubt regarded the shape of the archer among the sea of stars, and created an engine that could launch them across the inky vastness like the arrows of that fierce hunter. But now, a further complication arises in your mind. The locators did not converge on one spot exactly. There are four locators, each fixed on one particularly bright star. But again, there is but one portal from which one might depart. You doubt that there's a branching path or any mechanism for steering once you've plunged in, so the ancients must have established a further mechanism for directing the passageway. But what mechanism? The statue is gone. The podium, as far as you can tell, is solved. And there is no other tangible surface or object which might be easily manipulated by hand. How then did the ancients chart their course into the infinite expanse? And by what mechanism did they first gaze upon these alien worlds? And how did their first brave pioneers return from across the void? The answers to these questions must be found in this room, but unless some clever metaphor embedded in the stone reliefs should reveal itself, you doubt you will make much progress. You'd think they'd at least leave instructions, wouldn't you? You throw your hands up and pace about, racking your brain for any morsel of insight. Abu Bakr watches you going hither and thither until a firm hand on your sleeve anchors you in place.
Would you leave a map, an address, and a vehicle to someone set on ending your life? We have only been acquainted with the builders of this place through stone. If they were alive and able, I am certain that they left long ago.
And as far as we've seen, they didn't even leave a single bone behind.
What does that tell you? They did not want anyone to follow.
But if what you say is true, then why leave the place standing at all? Why not permanently close the doorway once you're through it?
Sentiment is a powerful thing, my friend. No matter how far one goes, you can always hear the call of home.
And those things out there have doubtless had the time as well to figure this place out. Certainly, more than we had. So, why are they still here?
Perhaps you need a break. You have made more progress in one day than I have in, well, a little longer than that. Lay down, have a nap, and perhaps in your brief rest, you will find some clarity.
You know, maybe just a few minutes wouldn't hurt. But no sooner than you stoop down to the floor does the equipment screech, signaling some great burst of energy akin to the nearby portal. You leap to your feet, scrambling for your weapon as the din of war begins to echo throughout the chamber. You can hear the sound of cannons and rifle fire, and then you hear screaming and hurried footsteps echoing through the corridors. You rush to defend the entrance, and find Seamus and just a handful of soldiers beating a hasty retreat, turning to fire back at some unseen foe. Seamus waves for you to get out of the way, and then rounds the corner into the observatory, turning on his heels to fire from behind cover.
"The hell is going on?" you scream.
"We've been abandoned. Those freaks returned in even bigger numbers, and they swarmed the walls before the turrets could wake up."
Seamus squeezes off a few rounds, dissuading a number of shadowy figures from entering the corridor.
"Someone triggered the emergency beacon to save their own skin, so now we're stuck!"
Seamus fires off a plasma grenade, which rolls to the end of the corridor and explodes, knocking back the enemy just as they begin to swarm the entrance. As always, the relentless shades simply carry off the fallen without concern for you. Themselves. They advance slowly, conveying their strange crossbows, only to be mowed down by rifle fire. And yet, still more press inward. You feel the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and you wheel around to spot yet more of the enemy pressing inward from the other entrance. You and Abu Bakr rush over and open fire, driving the enemy back, if only for a moment. Any illusions of a heroic last stand are quickly dashed, however, as you run out of ammunition and are forced to retreat from a barrage of energetic blasts. Taking refuge against the walls, you and Abu Bakr look across the room to Seamus and his remaining soldiers. You have no doubt that the desperation on Seamus' face perfectly mirrors your own. But when you see his eyes shifting to the swirling vortex in the center of the room, a twinge in his eye that drains the blood from your veins. Seamus doesn't hesitate, especially not once the enemy begins to pour into the room. And in that moment, sense departs from you too. An instinct takes hold. It's certain death against, well, you don't know. But if there's a chance, that's good enough. Exploding from your spot on the wall, you and Abu Bakr race for the heart of the room, narrowly escaping the enemy crossfire. And before you even realize it, you're airborne, hurling yourself down the throat of the vortex as the shadowy figures come within arm's reach of you. But instead, you slip through the grasp of those grisly hordes and plunge into the blinding heart of chaos. Your eyes part, if only a sliver. That is enough to let in the strange, rusty hues which dance about somewhere high above. You feel a chill coursing through your body, and you are startled to see the faint clouds which betray your breathing in the frigid air. Looking past your own breath, you gaze up at the thick, dark, undulating clouds which block almost all luminance, save for the ruddy rays which pierce the canopy. Cast your hands about and affirm that you are at least on solid ground, your fingers and palms scraping over rough, if level, stone. And finding your strength, you prop yourself up on your shoulders, and then you can finally get a better look at the alien realm to which you were transported. The sight of it all sends you flying to your feet. For a moment, wonder if your sight is betraying you. As you look upon the familiar, yet foreign, landscape, you think that perhaps the gateway led you not to somewhere, but somewhen. The thought even crosses your mind that you never stepped through the portal, and that all you're seeing now is perhaps the panicked firing of neurons as your brain begins to accept the end of your body. But it all feels too real. And as Seamus, Abu Bakr, and the surviving soldiers stir, likewise rising to meet a strange and surreal sight, you find a measure of certainty that you are at least in the realm of the living. The only other certainty you have is that you have at least followed one path upon which the builders of ancient Athlone once trod. Far off in the distance, crowning steep mountains are the ringed walls of mighty cities. The circuits gird the mountains, one concentric ring after another, rising up to where all too familiar domes crown the peaks. Even at this distance, you can make out the hut-like shapes of the structures within the ringed cities. But that's all the landscape will surrender to you. The rest is cloaked in a thick fog from which the mountains and their ringed cities emerge like islands in the vastness of the ocean. How high the mountains truly are is beyond comprehension, save for what assumptions you can make about distance and the legibility of the structures within the city. Your more immediate surroundings are rather odd as well. it's fairly apparent that you are all atop a hill, standing on a platform made of stone, surrounded by the crumbled remains of ancient walls, with much of the masonry bearing the spiraling designs which coursed through Athlone's streets. The descent from the platform just barely emerges from the mist itself, raised above the rest of the hill to form a staircase, flanked on both sides by upright stones lacking any trace of artifice. The path is anything but inviting, and with the somewhat hellish cast to everything you can see, you half expect to find Lake Cocytus at the bottom of the descent, with the mists parting only at the behest of bat-like wings far surpassing the sails of any galleon. Might you wander down into the gnashing jaws of the supreme traitor? For once, you have no desire to satisfy your curiosity.
I fear we did not chart our course well,
Abubakar says as he surveys the surroundings.
If legend holds any truth here, then the Duade Danann retreated to the other world, a place not unlike the peaceful meadows of Elysium. But then, I can hardly say we have stumbled upon such a paradise.
Seamus heaves up his weapon and peers through his scope, trying to get a read on anything he can, but like you and Abubakar, confusion seizes him.
Did we end up jumping into the future? Those cities we're looking at are just like the ones we were exploring before. And the gateway, it looked like it was shooting us across the galaxy, but I have this strange feeling we got dumped right back where we started.
There is another realm, which the old stories tell of. A place ruled by an ancient drowned king. A land beyond the reaches of the sea, far to the west, where only the soul may embark upon the journey, and from which none can return.
In plain English, please, barks Seamus. Are you telling me we're dead? Are you saying we went to hell or something?
No, not hell. Not exactly. I believe we have trespassed upon the land known as Tektuin, the underworld.
Abubakar's words shake you to your core. You've been to many places across the vast reaches of space and time. But now, it may be that you've pierced the veil of the universe itself, wandered into a realm into which only shades might gain entrance. You can't accept that conclusion, and you find yourself shaking your head, pacing back and forth as Abubakar continues with his speculation.
Whatever this place is, it's clear that the builders of the gateway did in fact leave their mark here. Perhaps it is merely a stopover to wherever they actually fled. One cannot be sure. All I know is that our enemies did not follow us. And that at least as far as I can see, this is no paradise.
Then, where do we go from here? You ask. As if to answer your own question, your eyes turn back to the staircase leading down into the fog-covered depths. You strain to look past the misty facade, but to little avail. Only one way, I guess.
Assuming those cities are anything like the ones we just came from, then there should be another gateway we can take, right?
Seamus marches to the edge of the platform and peers through his scope, looking in the general direction of the nearest city.
I'd bet any of those domes can at least get us started on our way back.
Of that I have little doubt, says Abubakar. We have no choice as it is. If we stay here, we are as good as dead.
Seamus nods and signals for his crew to muster. You remember your weapon and find it not far from where you're standing. The pulse rifle is scuffed and dented, but it looks serviceable. And you do manage to find one magazine with a painfully low round count registering on its display. Everyone lines up at the edge of the platform, preparing to march down into the unknown.
We should hope for all our sakes that this place is abandoned. If there is anyone here, I doubt we would be wanting to make their acquaintance.
Seamus primes his rifle and points it down into the fog below.
Oh, that's fine by me. I'm not looking to make friends here.
Seamus signals for everyone to move out. And with that, he leads the column down into the mist, his weapon raised, and every step taken with supreme caution. And soon enough, only you and Abu Bakr remain on the platform. And just as you finish taking a deep breath, steeling yourself for the descent, a thought comes to mind.
Abu Bakr, I'm hoping, like you said, that this place is abandoned. But our track record hasn't been great so far. Is there anyone in the Legends that we should be worrying about in particular?
A troubled smile appears on Abu Bakr's face, but it melts away quickly, replaced by a grimace. He too begins his march down into the mist, gesturing for you to follow as he does. You linger a moment, and then finally follow when he gestures at you again, this time with greater urgency. You come up right behind him, and it's then that he stops for a moment and peers back at you.
Tekduin might be called the Underworld, but I admit that is not the best translation. It is more accurately known as the House of the Dark One.
That was Rings in the Mist, Part 2, by Kevin Falbinese. Again, this show was created entirely with the support of our patrons, and would not have happened without them. If you enjoyed this show, and you would like to increase the number of shows like this that our team can produce, please join us on Patreon. We have story creators standing by, hungry to create shows. And it pains me when they ask if they can create a show and I have to tell them, sorry, not this month. We need more patrons. So please come and join us on Patreon. You'll get early access to shows like this one. In fact, our patrons first heard Rings in the Mist a year ago. You'll get a ton of shows not available to the public. You'll get to explore worlds like this underwater post-apocalyptic Soviet city in the Arctic, or an industrialized Rome. You'll get Twilight Histories merch in the mail as rewards. You'll get items such as stickers, t-shirts, mugs, or a hoodie. And most important of all, and the real reason why you're joining, you'll be investing in the future of the Twilight Histories. There's so much we want to do with the show, and we can't do it without you. So please, join us on Patreon by visiting the website at twilighthistories.com. Then follow the link. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.